Hello, welcome to the House of Commons podcast. This is a weekly podcast about politics where we talk about what has happened in the political world in the previous week. I'm Mark Thompson, former Lib Dem blogger and now independent blogger, and I'm joined by my co-host Emma Burnell, who is a Labour blogger who blogs at Scarlet Standard. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. We are recording this on Sunday, the 1st of December, 2013. We're going to try and cover three subjects from this week. So the first one we wanted to talk about, or that I wanted to talk about, was civil service reform. So there's been a bit of coverage of this in the last couple of days. I actually heard Sir Robin Butler, who is a former senior civil servant. I think he was actually the most senior civil servant at one point, cabinet secretary, I think under Tony Blair. And he has really gone for Francis Maude in particular, but the government in general. He made some rather extraordinary comments for a former Mandarin. I mean, normally the way that those people speak, it's very, very measured and, you know, very carefully phrased. And he actually said that he doesn't think that Francis Maude understands about leadership. And actually, he said he thinks that applies to a number of ministers in this government. And this is coming off the back of some discussion about whether the civil service itself should take more responsibility and be more accountable directly for things that happen. So I think this relates to things like, you know, when IT systems are procured and then there's cock-ups and things like what's happened with universal credit and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we know about all kinds of different programs that have been rolled out or attempted to have been rolled out, say, over the last 15 years, and there have been various problems. And I think some people are now starting to question whether the civil service itself needs to be more directly accountable for those, rather than it always just falling on the ministers and the politicians to carry the can, and the civil service essentially being protected from that. What do you think about this, Emma?
Well, I think that there are two ways round of looking at this. If you want the civil service to have to be openly accountable when things go wrong, they also need to be able to openly defend themselves. And at the moment, the rules tell them they can't. So, for example, Ian Duncan Smith is going around doing absolutely everything he can to pass the buck to his senior civil servant on the failure of universal credit. And there is no way in which that senior civil servant can, whilst keeping his job, stand up for himself. So you can't have accountability without also being able to defend yourself. And at the moment, what worries me is the conversation is going far too far in one direction without actually looking at the rights of those civil servants to back themselves up.
Yeah, but isn't there a point, though, that they have been largely protected historically from this sort of thing? I mean, it is, if there's a major cock-up, it is the minister or ministers who get the blame, and they might resign, they might not, but they're the ones who get fingered for it, aren't they?
Well, they are the ones who are implementing the ideas, whether those ideas are workable or not. So, for example, universal credit. I suspect lots and lots of people will have told Ian Duncan Smith, do you know what, mate, this ain't going to work. Ian Duncan Smith said, no, we'll do it anyway, whatever you say. So it's his responsibility that it is that an undeliverable system is being attempted to be delivered. In the end of the day, the buck does stop at the top.
Okay, but let's put Ian Duncan Smith to one side, because we regularly slag him off on this podcast, and, you know, I have my problems with him as well, but it's broader than just IDS. I mean, if we look at what happened with the IT system for the NHS that the previous Labour government tried to roll out, and there were billions of pounds spent on that, and it just didn't work. And it's Labour and the Labour Party and the Labour ministers who were in charge at the time who basically get the blame for that. But I mean, it strikes me that the government structures and, you know, Whitehall isn't set up for this sort of thing. They really struggle with things like IT projects. And ultimately, whose fault is that? I mean, is that the politician's fault? Often you've got politicians, let's say when this government came in, they just come in and they want to get on with stuff. If the mechanisms and the machinery just aren't in place to be able to do these things, then whose fault is it? Because it kind of feels like in the end, although you might blame politicians, it's sort of no one's fault.
I don't doubt that our civil service needs reform. I think there is a great deal of silo working happening. I think there's a great deal of lack of information sharing. Now, sometimes that is to do with the mechanisms. Sometimes that's to do with concerns by people like yourself, Mark, who don't like data sharing within government, which makes it a lot harder to do these things. But I fully accept the case for civil service reform. I don't think the civil service reflects the way 21st century government needs to work. But that's not the same thing as pushing the blame away from ministers and onto individual civil servants.
But what concerns me is, I mean, it sounds like we both agree that there are structural problems with the civil service and with how programmes are rolled out. And, you know, it does feel to me like, you know, you have, you know, private sector companies like Amazon and like others who very quickly, from almost nothing, can build up infrastructure to be able to do incredible things. And yet when it comes to Whitehall, they really struggle to do those sorts of things.
There's a great deal of difference from building up from the ground and rebuilding something that exists. That's much, much, much harder.
I completely agree. And the question I was going to ask actually is, how can this happen and who can even do it? Because it kind of drains up job of trying to completely rebuild how the civil service works. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, and you see it in like Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, where the civil service basically oppose anything, and, you know, they use their wiles to oppose reform and, you know, oppose changing things. And they're very, very conservative. They want to keep the status quo. So how would someone go about doing that? Whoever wanted to do it, whether it was the politicians, whether the mandarins themselves recognize it all has to change. How could it happen?
I think it's about incremental change in some ways. I think it's about bringing through people to the leadership roles that understand the case for change and want to make that happen. I think it's also about a much greater diffusion of power through different levels of national government and into local government. I think it's about, you know, so many different things, so many things that have been talked about under this government quite well, yet not delivered nearly so well. So, for example, the localism bill was kind of a missed opportunity to do some of this stuff. And, you know, no top-down reorganisations was a good catchphrase and not so much a delivery in a number of different departments. You know, there are ways of bringing people with you, and there are ways of just simply antagonising people so that they will always stand against you. And that's not just IDS. Certainly, we hear a lot of that from the Department for Education and Michael Gove, who seems to have entirely decided that his job is to wind everybody else who cares about education up. Now, you know, he may have different vision for education from those people, and it's up to him to negotiate how to implement his vision as the Secretary of State. But it doesn't seem sensible to just simply be a battle axe rather than a negotiator.
Well, one thing that could help try and inject more change and more impetus for change within the civil service and its structures could be to have something that was a bit more akin to what they have in the US. So I'm not saying we should try and emulate the system, because it's a very different system.
Broken. It's sorry? Completely broken as well. I mean, the American system is grinding to a halt.
But yeah, I'm sorry. I'll be more specific. So I'm not specifically talking about the kind of the exact political structures. What I mean is that when a new president is elected, they have 3 months where they go through and they appoint a transition team, and lots of people in that transition team then end up in what in this country would be the senior civil service positions. So here we have a kind of permanent civil service, and then there are politicians on top of that. In the US, they do have like an equivalent of the civil service, but that's at the lower levels. The more senior ranks are filled by political appointments. If we had something that tried to get a bit closer to that, do you not think that that might help this particular problem? It might have its own problems, but in terms of trying to change how the civil service operates, could that not help?
I think you would create newer, bigger problems in order to solve this problem. I think there's a lot to be, you know, there are problems with institutional memory, but there's also a great deal to be said for it. And if you just try and go in with a whole new bunch of people with absolutely nobody with any experience of delivery, I think that you just have real issues there.
But, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily, you see, because it slightly flies in the face of what you said earlier on, because you said about, you know, bringing new people in. And I think one of the problems with the civil service...
Yeah, but I mean, new people through.
Yeah, but one of the problems with the civil service is
that difference.
People usually end up in senior positions in the civil service because they're a civil service person through and through. They've worked there for 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. They started at a junior level. They've been promoted internally. So they already think in a very hidebound way that is the civil service way of doing things. Whereas if you were able to bring people into more senior positions who had experience of other ways of delivery from the private sector, maybe from other public sector organisations, but outside of Whitehall, then it might be that that kind of thing could be injected more into it. I think a little bit of what I've just said.
I think it's incredibly rude and patronising to say to people who've spent 20 years dedicating their life to public service that they are automatically hidebound simply because that's what they've done.
Well, I mean, the evidence is in front of us, isn't it?
Not necessarily. There are a few bad cases and there are a few good cases. We're not talking about all the civil service successes because they're not allowed to be celebrated. We don't hear about what they do well because the ministers get all the credit for that.
Okay,
but if we're going to start heaping blame on them, let's start equally heaping praise where it's due.
Yeah, of course. And of course there are good things that happen with the civil service, but there are a lot of bad things that happen. And this discussion is about how do we improve that.
Well, there are many ways to improve that, but simply telling everybody who's worked there for a certain length of time that they're hidebound and useless is not one of the ways I would choose.
Well, I didn't say hidebound and useless, did I? I said that there is a particular mentality within the civil service that makes change difficult, and it is because most of the people in senior positions have been promoted internally. You see this kind of problem in the private sector as well. When you have companies that only promote internally or predominantly promote internally, they struggle to change. And, you know, you see, I mean, an example would be Kodak. Kodak did what they did brilliantly. They even invented the digital camera in 1975. And yet by about 2 or 3 years ago, they were just completely all at sea and they went bust. And it was because they just kept doing what they'd always done in the way that they'd always done it. And the market just completely changed. You see this again and again in the private sector. It's not just a public sector phenomenon. But if you can inject some kind of new blood at a more senior level, and I'm not saying all senior civil servants are useless and idiots. I never said that, and I don't mean that. I'm saying if you want to affect change, you can't. If you keep doing what you've done in the past, you're not going to get the kind of change that you're talking about.
How do you get the best people to join the civil service when they're young if they know they won't be promoted?
I didn't say they wouldn't be promoted, and I'm not advocating that all people in senior positions in the civil service should be promoted from outside. I'm saying it should happen more than it does at the moment. You're caricaturing my position, Emma. I'm not saying what you're saying.
I can think of quite a few civil servants who have been brought in from outside. So it's not that it doesn't happen.
Yeah, but it needs...
It is already happening and it is not changing the thing you want to change. So maybe that's not the answer.
Well, I mean, I think it's a complex problem, isn't it? But I don't know how many senior civil service appointments have come from outside. It doesn't feel like that many from what I've seen. So I mean, I can't give.
But we can probably name 3 or 4, 5 senior civil servants. But across the board, I suspect there are a lot more, and I know there are several more who've been recruited from out externally. So I think we're not really dealing with facts here. We're dealing with our suppositions of the civil service, some of which, both of us, I suspect, are based on a sitcom from 20, 30 years ago.
It's a bit more than that. I think it's based on kind of how we know the civil service operates, isn't it?
Well, some of it is, but some of it is based on our supposition of how we think the civil service operates.
Okay, so what would you, if you had a magic wand and you could just decide what needed to happen, I mean, do you think it needs to change particularly radically anyway? Because it seems like you're pretty pissed off with stuff that's happened under this government, but you seem to blame the politicians. But lots of things went wrong under Labour. I mean, I wouldn't sit here and try and blame Labour for all of the things that went wrong.
You know, I think Labour were responsible for some of the things that went wrong. I think that Labour were too easily led into buying shiny tech. I think the shiny tech problem is, you know, civil servants will try it on with a minister to see if they can get them to buy their latest scheme. I think ID cards was one of those ones that was presented to every single Home Office minister since time memorial, and then one day someone went, yeah, all right, then let's do that. Shiny tech is always a problem, and human beings are a problem. We are never going to have a system that is perfect because it will always be run by imperfect people because all people are imperfect. I think there are political responsibilities, there are civil service responsibilities. My issues are, if we're going to start publicly blaming civil servants, we have to give them public platforms to defend themselves. Otherwise, it's completely unfair, which, you know, politicians have. If we're going to start blaming them, we also need to start praising them, which doesn't happen at the moment. And we will then change the civil service, change the nature of the service part of the civil service. into a completely different being. What I would like to see is much, much more cross-departmental working, much less silos, really breaking down the silos, having a civil service that doesn't necessarily attach itself to different ministries, but works as a pooled civil service, perhaps, and that might break down the culture issues a lot more. And I would like to see more people at more junior levels having a more ability to say where things are going wrong on the delivery front, because they're the people who more likely know about this stuff.
Well, the shiny, I mean, there's, I think, two things you said that are very interesting. The shiny tech thing, I mean, coming from, you know, I've been working in tech for nearly 20 years now. So I know that, you know, there can be good, very good IT solutions to problems rolled out. And I know that when it comes to things like the NHS and like big public sector organisations, they're very big, they're very unwieldy, and it's very difficult. But it strikes me that we've almost reached a point now where we just assume that if the government's going to roll out a major IT system, it ain't going to work full stop, almost to the point now where I think governments will be very, very wary of that in the future. And yet it doesn't have to be like that. IT systems can solve big problems if they're managed properly and correctly and scoped properly, and perhaps not subject to you know, the kind of political problems that systems like this are bound to be subjected to. I don't know what the answer is, but to just say that, you know, shiny tech is a problem, and I do fear that there's a real risk of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
I'm saying that particularly the last Labour government were of its time in a way that they were, you know, tech was the future, therefore anything tech was good and it wasn't questioned properly. You know, we have a shiny technological solution, okay, I'll have that. There was no questioning as to whether that was they were the right solutions at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. I just fear that because there's been so many high profile failures, that government and government systems will fall further and further behind. Actually, but let's just address the other side of this coin, because as you rightly pointed out earlier on, we just always talk about the failures. And actually, that's something that really irritates me about political coverage, the fact that it's always the negative stuff that gets the coverage. And, you know, we're doing the same thing here. But something like direct.gov, I think, has been a big success. It's mm-hmm. brought a lot of government services under one umbrella. People understand that, you know, you go to directgov.co.uk and that then gives you the services that you need. And a lot of those systems work very well. I mean, you know, for the last few years, I've been renewing my car tax online, and it's just takes like 30 seconds, and it's all automated, and it checks your insurance and your MOT, and it just does it. And then you just get it through the post. There's no more queuing up in post office for half an hour on a lunch break. You know, so there are good things. It's just that, you know, there have been very, very bad things as well. And the bad things have cost a hell of a lot of money. You know, and that's, like you say, that's what people remember. So I think, you know, if the, I like I say, I don't know the answer, but having worked in IT, I know that there are ways to do this. And there are private sector companies that have been able to do, you know, very, very complex things, but usually distributed across lots of areas. I mean, maybe one of the problems with Whitehall is that it tries to centralize and control everything from the center. And if things could be more devolved, which I think you might have alluded to earlier on, then yes, that could help as well. There was something else you said in your bit earlier on, and I can't remember what it was now. There were two things I was going to pick up on another one. Oh, well, I can't remember it. Okay. Well, shall we move on then?
Yes.
Okay. So the next thing we wanted to talk about was energy bills. And I mean, I feel like, is this about the 10th time we've talked about this subject now? We seem to talk about it every bloody week. But the reason it's come up again is because, well, let's see if I can characterise from my perspective what I think has happened this week. A few weeks ago, Ed Miliband made a speech in which he said that he wanted to freeze energy bills for 20 months. The government, and David Cameron in particular, but basically the whole government, had a pop at Ed Miliband, claimed that this was socialism and Marxism, and it all seemed to be linked to his father as well, to Ed Miliband's father. And there was a big furore about that. But basically, it was Labour are in favour of freezing energy bills and the government aren't. But this week, what seems to have happened is that, well, first of all, we had the whole green crap thing last week or the week before, where Cameron seems to be wanting to move to shift taxes from directly being related to energy bills to being part of general taxation. But also, behind the scenes, it now appears that the government has been lobbying energy companies to kind of voluntarily, in quotes, freeze energy prices, probably until the next election. So on the one hand, the government has a pop at Ed Miliband for being a Marxist. And on the other hand, the government then secretly, behind the scenes, tries to get the companies to do what Ed Miliband was suggesting anyway, but voluntarily. Does that sound about right?
We should keep it quiet, Mark.
Sorry?
It's okay to be a Marxist, you've just got to do it secretly.
Yeah, well, maybe we can come to Marxism separately, but I kind of feel like I'm being a bit unfair.
Yeah, I mean, it's just bonkers. I mean, the government have had a weird old week anyway, because they seem to, on the day that this came out in the BBC, they denied it, and then they kind of went, yeah, actually, we did do it, then no, we didn't. And the same thing happened on plain cigarette packaging, where they had a U-turn on it, and then they U-turned on the U-turn, and then they U-turned on the U-turn on the U-turn. And I'm now confused as to whether we get plain cigarette packaging or not.
I think on plain cigarette
packaging. I don't think anyone in the Department of Health knows either, so.
I think they're having some kind of consultation, aren't they? But I think they already had a consultation, so yeah, it's a bit of a mess.
But the government do seem to be slightly all at sea at the moment. And I think the thing that can be definitely said is that Labour have, since the party conference season, been setting the political weather and been setting the agenda. Now, you know, we're a very long way from the next election, and that's going to be a hard momentum to keep up. So I suspect it'll go back and forth a bit. But what one of the major criticisms of Ed Miliband in the past has been that he's had these kind of interventions and then silences. And they weren't, although the interventions themselves were pretty good, they weren't really followed up. So they fell, you know, in a desert. And that certainly hasn't been the case since party conference. There seems to be a lesson learned there, and they've really kept the pressure up, kept the momentum up, kept Ed Miliband's profile up as well, making sure that it's Ed leading the fight, but making sure that the whole Labour Party's kind of stepping in line behind him. And the government do seem to be on the ropes, certainly over some of these very, very symbolic cost of living issues.
Well, what this reminds me of is something that happened when Labour were in government a few years ago. And bear in mind that this happened when Labour was sort of in the fag end. I mean, they'd been in for over 10 years at this point. So maybe it wasn't that surprising that they were kind of running out of steam and that the opposition was, you know, starting to set the agenda. What it reminds me of is when Osborne made his announcement about inheritance tax, and that then seemed to be a game changer. It seemed to contribute towards the whole election that never was.
Yes.
And then a few weeks later, Alistair Darling, with his arm almost visibly kind of pushed up behind his back by Brown, made some announcement. So it wasn't exactly what Osborne had announced, but it was along the lines of couples will be able to share entitlement, and that could be kind of passed on even if one person in the couple died. So it was an approximation of what Osborne had announced. And I remember when Darling announced it at the dispatch box and Brown was sitting behind him, you saw Cameron and Osborne's reaction, which was basically to point at them and say, that's our policy, you've just stolen. And yeah, Brown pointing at them from across the dispatch box and laughing. And that, for me, was one of the landmark images of Brown's premiership, because it just struck me, he just really didn't have any ideas. The opposition was setting the agenda, and the best he could do is steal their clothes and then point and laugh at them and say, well, what are you going to do? We've just nicked it off you. That was pretty much what he was doing. And this reminds me of that. And yet this government has only been in for just over 3 years. How can they have got to a position where the leader of the opposition is setting the agenda in such a way that they have to so blatantly go and steal the ideas? It's not even as if they waited 6 months or a year and then did something that was tangentially related so that they could, you know, make a good fist of saying we haven't stolen their policies. It's a few weeks later and they're blatantly trying to do exactly what Miliband suggested, albeit, in quotes, voluntarily for the companies. Yeah. This doesn't tell a good story about this government in the same way as that whole inheritance tax furore didn't about Brown.
Yeah, I mean, it's the government have, at the same time as Lyndon Crosby is trying to convince the government that cost of living isn't the issue that they need to be campaigning on, they are flailing around desperately trying to counter Labour's cost of living policies. And that's because they have salience, they are the right things to do, and they are relevant to the country, and they speak to things that Cameron Osborne, I mean, Cameron Osborne's biggest problem is that they are seen as not in touch with the electorate. Their weakest polling points are always out of touch with the electorate, not in it for me, my family will be better off under Labour. And they were counting on a renewed economy turning them around and winning the election for them. But if people don't feel that the economy is getting better, if the lived experience of ordinary people is not getting better, and it's not, then that will do nothing for them, because people think the economy is my pocket.
Well, I mean, there's perhaps more than one way of looking at that, because I think that Osborne would be pretty wary if the economy really started to roar ahead in the next year, because I think his fear would then be that if the economy really seemed to be on the mend, and, you know, the standard of living was actually rocketing up, and it was clear that we were way out of the recession and we were well into another boom, then I think his fear would be that people might think, OK, well, now we can let Labour back in. Whereas if things are still quite tough, then I think that he might think that that would be a better position to be in. So things are better, but they're still not completely right. Because then he can argue that we started
an economy where the figures are going up, but the experiences are not. And, you know, that's going to be absolute political poison.
Well, I mean, it's clear from the way the government has reacted that they're running scared on energy prices and, you know, more broadly, cost of living more generally. You know, I don't think they'd be just because Ed Miliband's made a speech doesn't mean that the government's going to react in this way. What has happened, as you said, is he's made a speech on an issue that resonates with people. And energy prices are something, you know, from my perspective, my personal perspective, it's been pissing me off for the last few years. Every year it's 6%, 8%, 10%. They just keep going up and up and up and up. And I can't really see why that should be. OK, so energy prices, you know, have maybe gone up, but energy prices go down sometimes. I mean, you know, you look at the price of oil and it on a graph and it's up and down, up and down, up and down. And yet the prices only ever seem to go one way. You know, I don't know enough about it to know all the details. And there seems to have been a lot of discussion about this in the last few months. And I still don't really understand why it's happening the way it's happening. So, you know, it's not surprising that the general public just think, do you know what, this is ridiculous and something needs to happen about it. I mean, I actually think that in a few years' time, we could be looking at a renationalised energy market, because I'm not sure we can carry on like this for years and years and years. You know, if the government's getting to the point where it's intervening and saying, look, you've got to hold the prices down, you're almost at the point where what's the point in having private companies? You might as well have it back under state ownership. And I think there's actually a majority of the public would be behind that. Certainly at the moment, whether that will sustain is another question. But I think if it was to happen right now, I think it...
Yeah, polling suggests that they would be at the moment. The polling is way to the left of where Ed has gone.
Yeah. But like I say, I mean, I just don't think it tells a very good story about this government. And you pointed out, Emma, that we're still a long way away from the election. But I mean, I would say that actually, you know, that gives Labour 18 months to be able to keep doing this. You know, if Ed can pick two or three more high salience issues like this and place himself on the side of overwhelming public opinion and then force the government onto the back foot and have to do something about it, I think that would put him in an incredibly powerful position. And I'd be very surprised if him and his colleagues weren't strategising right now to do just that.
I'm sure they are. And I think it's really important. I mean, you're right, yes. And I think the other interesting thing is the media narrative is starting to turn around. The media have been looking for a new narrative. They had Ed as the loser for 3 years. And all of a sudden, they're starting to scent blood in the water of number 10. And actually, they're quite enjoying having a different story to write.
Yeah, I wouldn't count on that lasting very long, though. I don't think we're in kind of Major versus Blair territory, where the press is...
We're not in Major versus Blair territory, but we're also not the other way round, which is where they were trying to paint it 2 years ago.
I think
Cameron is not winning the leadership argument against Ed as convincingly as everybody thought he was going to.
No, I agree, but I do think as we get closer to an election, the press will largely fall in line behind Cameron. I mean, it'll be, you know, the Mirror...
Oh, the right-wing press will, to a large extent, yeah. I mean, what will happen is that the right-wing press who've been flirting with UKIP will fall back in line.
Yeah.
But I'm not talking about just the right-wing press. I'm talking about the whole press narrative, and the attacks that they've had on Ed are shifting.
Mm.
And they are a little bit confused as to where those attacks are landing and where they aren't.
Mm.
And I think that's what's really changing.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, you may well be right.
And the other thing is they've basically thrown everything, including the kitchen sink, at Ed for the last 3 years, and he's bounced back. How much further can they go?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure we shall see how much further they can go, but it will be very, very interesting, because what Ed has made very, very clear, particularly with this fight with the Daily Mail over that disgusting article about his dad, was that, you know, I'm not just going to sit there and take it. Why should I?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Nick Clegg could tell him a thing or two about, you know, getting, you know, really, really negative press coverage and very, very unfair press coverage in the 2 or 3 weeks before a general election. I don't underestimate that the press will have some stuff up their sleeve that they will just drop like a bomb a couple of weeks out before polling day. But yeah.
Maybe they'll pick up the Daily Sports Ralph Miliband killed my kitten story.
Or maybe. I mean, this whole kind of cyclic thing that the press do of building someone up and then knocking them down again. I mean, Cameron does suffer from that thing that Brown seemed to be obsessed with, which is that he's been at the top for a very long time. And by the time of the next election, he'll have been at the top for pretty much 10 years. I mean, he became Tory leader at the end of 2005. By May 2015, he'll have been either leader of the opposition or prime minister for 9.5 years. He's been around a long time. And actually, something that maybe Brown didn't particularly highlight is that Cameron's been at the top for a period of nearly a decade, at a time when we have an accelerated political culture and, you know, media coverage is the 24-hour cycle. I mean, something that was news yesterday is, you know, is almost forgotten about the day after in a lot of cases because the agenda's moved on. So he has been through a lot of accelerated cycles. You know, he's been at the top at that time, and therefore, you know, we all know Cameron very, very well. Another thing actually that I heard the other day, which I thought was a very, very good point, is that Cameron was around in a very senior position, as in leader of the opposition, before the crash. So he had a lot of things that he said that he's on record of saying, all this Hugger Husky stuff and Hugger Hoodie and all of that stuff. That was actually at a very different time economically.
No wonder they tried to wipe it all.
Well, yeah, that slightly ties in with what we talked about the other week. But the point the person who said this was making, I think it might have been on another podcast I was listening to, was saying that Ed Miliband doesn't have that problem, because although he was, you know, an advisor to Brown, he wasn't really a frontline politician, a proper, you know, senior level frontline politician until he became leader of the opposition in 2010. So therefore, he's been able to set out his stall and his positions all with the economy the way it is now. So Cameron is a little bit stuck in that respect. And I do wonder, I actually can't see how the electorate is going to look at Cameron in 2015 and think, you are the answer. I just can't see how that's going to happen.
Well, me neither, but, you know, if a week is a long time in politics, the 18 months till the next election is.
Okay.
An eternity.
Indeed. The final thing that we can talk about today is food banks. So I only just really become aware of this about half an hour ago when you messaged me on Twitter about it, Emma. So do you want to just explain it? It's about food banks and it's about how the Red Cross
The Red Cross are collecting food donations for the first time since the Second World War. They are addressing the crisis of food poverty in the UK, which has reached crisis level and is going to really hit home this winter. And I think this talks to what we were talking about earlier with the cost of living questions. And you know, the lower down the income scale you get, the tighter those questions are. Something like 40-50% of people are choosing between heating and eating at times. And people are really, really concerned about these issues. And, you know, it's not just people who are on benefits, although that's a huge, huge part of it. And the squeeze on people on benefits with, you know, little for them to go to. You know, we are starving people, punitively, it seems, at times. And, you know, it doesn't strike me as the way to change the welfare system, which I'm quite happy to say needs reform, to starve people and to rely on charity donations where you know, that's a very difficult process to go through. It's not a very easy thing to control, thing to understand how the flow of that the products will go through, making sure that they're properly distributed to everybody that's in need. And it doesn't paint a good picture of the country that we are in the 21st century.
Okay, so I mean, I should start by saying I have no direct experience of this. I've never been to a food bank, and I, you know, luckily, have never needed to use that. All my life, so even when I was a child, there was always food on the table. I've never experienced not having enough food to eat. The fact that the Red Cross are doing this now, and it's the first time they've done it since 1945. From what you're saying, it sounds like you think that is of particular significance. I just want to slightly unpack that. Do you think that the situation now is the worst it's been in the last 68 years?
Yes.
So people are starving now in ways
now in ways that they were not since the Second World War, since the end of rationing at least.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know, because I, you know, like I say, I've only just picked the subject up. I know food banks have been in the news for several months, probably years, actually, at a fairly low level. I'm not really sure how to unpack this in a way that will be fair, because, like I say, it's not something I've got direct experience of. But it strikes me as an odd situation to be in if we are in a situation where this is the worst it's been since just after the war. I mean, just after the war, the economy was destroyed. You know, rationing was still in place. How can we be in a situation that's worse than that now? That doesn't feel right.
Not worse than that, but back to that.
Well, how can we be back to that? I mean, the economy's been through a tough time.
The economic model we have is not working. All the money is not... trickle-down economics has failed to trickle down, has done for years and years and years. And what we're seeing is the cumulative effect of all the money rising to the top, and the poorest being squeezed harder and harder and harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. And now, of course, we've got to a situation where there may be more money in the economy as a whole than there was at the end of the war, but it's not anything like as well distributed as it was.
Okay, so you think it's a failure of kind of capitalist economics to ensure that everyone in society has enough of a basic level of income to at least be able to feed themselves?
Yeah, I mean, if we look at the fact that wages have been outstripped by inflation every single month under this government, every single month, except one. Do you know what that one month was? What the thing that changed the figures significantly enough? The one month was the month that bankers got all their deferred bonuses so they could get them with lower tax after the Chancellor made the adjustments in his 2012 budget. So their bonuses were big enough to make a difference to that figure. And that figure is the only time that wages have outstripped inflation. So prices are rising and normal people's wages are going down and down and down. That's not a model that works.
Hmm. I kind of feel like maybe we need someone, you know, like a Tory or someone on from the right here to, you know, kind of maybe talk from the other side. Because like I say, I don't have enough knowledge about this to really be able to maybe, you know, question some of the things that you're saying here. It just doesn't feel like we can be 70 years on from the end of the Second World War and have not, you know, and have gone back to that kind of level. I mean, we're not in food rationing, you know.
Of course we're not, because people don't care that the poor are poor. The people in charge don't give a shit because they're the 1%, they're the 10% at the top.
But we have like a basic level.
If you just read that speech by Boris Johnson last week, greed is good. We have gone back to greed is good. Mm. Boris Gordon Gecko Johnson.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did read that speech today, and I saw Andrew Rawnsley's piece on it in The Observer. And yeah, I mean, that speech from Johnson was very, very poorly judged, I think. At any time, it would have been poorly judged. But I think particularly at the moment, it was... Yeah, I think that gives us a bit of a flavour of what we're likely to get if he gets anywhere near, you know, power at a national level.
And this is the man who's seen as the saviour of the Tory party.
Yeah, but I am going to challenge some of the stuff that you said, because otherwise I'm just going to sit here and just let you say what you say, and you know, and it's just going to go by unquestioned. the welfare system in this country does have a basic level that people are paid, whether they're working or whether they're not. And, you know, there are housing benefit paid and people are given housing. I mean, it surely cannot be as bad as it was 70 years ago. Just because the Red Cross have decided to get involved in this. I mean, food banks have been at the top of the political agenda now for months and months and months. And, you know, maybe one of the reasons why food banks have expanded so much is because it's one of these things, it's an idea whose time has come and it feeds upon itself. And the more people see them, the more people go down to donate and the more they expand. I mean, I was clearing out my cupboards last week and I thought, well, actually, I could take these down to a food bank. I haven't got around to doing it yet, but I wouldn't have thought about doing that a year or two ago. It wouldn't have occurred to me because I wasn't really aware that there were food banks around, whereas now I am. Do you not think at least that's part of the story?
You're not
here?
Pulling the old Tory, I can't remember which Tory minister it was, but food banks are there because people are enjoying getting free food. And
no,
it's like free
that's,
for all.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it's something that has kind of gained momentum. And the more it gains momentum, the more coverage it gets. And the more people start to realise food banks are out there and the more likely they are to donate. And the more also people are more likely to...
Mark, would you go to a food bank if you didn't have to?
No.
Would you go asking for free food if you didn't have to?
No, of course I wouldn't.
Then why would a poor person?
No, if I was in a situation where I did have to, and then I became aware that there were food banks there when maybe I hadn't been aware of them 6 months or a year before, then I would make use of it. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying people go to food banks out of choice. I'm saying that the fact that they're there might mean that people are using them more and that this is something that builds upon itself.
It's a good thing that we have them. It's an appalling thing that we need them. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but what I'm questioning is whether we need them more now than we did maybe in the 70s when there were economic problems and people were really struggling. And yet I think if you look at the figures, there were hardly any food banks around then compared to now.
Yes,
I'm not sure.
The welfare state has been massively desecrated to far, far further than it was since the 70s.
But I'm not sure you can look at the figures.
The cost of living crisis has gone up far worse than it was in the 70s.
Okay.
The 70s had a big, big, big inflation problem, but it wasn't as incremental as what we've been seeing. So it was quite a sort of sharp shock. And that had huge reverberations and massive... And I'm not going to say that it wasn't hugely problematic. But what we're seeing is not something that is a few shocks that hit the system. This is the system itself just spiralling out of control.
OK, so what do you think is going to happen? Do you think we're going to see loads more food banks? Do you think... I mean, I can't see that between now and the election... Inflation's going to drop to a level and wage increases are going to go up to a level where real term wage increases are going to start happening. It's probably not going to happen in the next 15 months. I think maybe in the next 2 or 3 years we might start to see that happen. And until that happens, do you think we're going to see food banks continue to rise and
yes.
things like this Red Cross initiative continue to expand?
I hope so. I hope that civic society can fill in where the government are failing so badly. But that's not the answer. The answer is not the sticking plaster we put on afterwards. The answer is to stop the wound happening in the first place. And for that, we need massive, massive structural change.
OK. So if Labour got in 18 months' time, do you think that they're going to be able to do what you'd want to see them do in order to alleviate this problem as you're describing it?
Do I think they'll be able to do it? Yeah, I think they're able to do it. I think they're able to do it intellectually. I think they'll struggle to do it politically.
Depends
how big a majority they can get. But
I mean, I wanted to pick up on that because when Labour were in power for 13 years, inequality actually increased, didn't it?
Well, no, it didn't. If you actually look at it, what happened was the massive increase in inequality that happened over the Conservative years was contracted. But what didn't happen was that it was stopped, but it didn't contract.
Okay, so
we stopped the rise in inequality. We didn't then reduce levels of inequality.
Okay. But I mean, that
the stopping the rise in itself was quite a big thing.
Well, OK, but that is what Labour is about, isn't it? It's about more equality. And if they
yeah.
weren't able to do it in 13 years, then
if
what
those
do you...
13 years were in the pre-crash economy. We are in a different place now. Labour is a massively different place politically and certainly economically. We are looking at very, very different approach to the economy under a Labour government than we did under New Labour.
So you have great confidence that if Labour were to get in, they would, I mean, subject to the constraints that you've just highlighted, which are
subject to the constraints,
size of majority, political, you know, political realities and all the rest of it. But if Labour got in with, say, 100 majority, you think that after 5 years, they would have had a decent shot at turning around the problems as you're describing them, and we would see food banks much reduced and all that sort of thing? Is that what you think?
That's what I believe, yeah. I think that the whole concept of Milibandism is about addressing things at source rather than addressing problems after they've happened.
He's got an ism now, has he?
He has. I've written about it, Mark. Have you not read my Milibandisms piece?
I might have done, but I probably took that term with a pinch of salt. He's still leader of the opposition. You don't get an ism until you're prime minister, and even then you often don't get one.
The opposition we've ever had, and he's allowed an ism as a result.
Well, there's no such thing as majorism, as far as I know. There's no such thing as brownism. I'd even question whether there's any such thing as Blairism.
But there is definitely a thing called Milibandism, and it is quite becoming very clear what that is, and it's about addressing problems at source.
We'll see. I'm a bit sceptical about whether he deserves the badge of ism yet. I think he has to actually do stuff before you can get that. Okay, well, like I say, I'm not sure.
Marx was never in government, but we still talk about Marxism.
Yeah, but his ideas have been tried in numerous governments around the world for decades with not much success.
I thought, and that makes him like a civil servant, you see. We need the shock of the new Mark.
Wasn't that a television series in about 1984 about modern art?
Possibly.
I know too much about old television. That's my problem. I'm not sure I've done a decent enough fist of kind of putting the other side here, because I think the truth is I sort of deep down suspect that you're right. I'm not sure I think you're right that it's worse than it's been for 70 years, but I do think it's pretty bad. And I don't think the Red Cross would be doing this if they didn't see a real need for it. And it does worry me. I think maybe we might need to revisit this subject with someone who could give, a more right wing perspective on how things are happening. And maybe, you know, we could question them about, you know, obviously, as you see it, the solutions aren't working. But, you know, get them to defend it and you know, talk from the other side. Just before we finish, Emma, you're not going to be on the podcast next week because you're going into hospital for an operation this week.
Yes, I am. I'm having a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass operation. So by this time next year, I'll be skinky malinky, is the plan.
Okay. So Roux-en-Y, that actually sounds like a place in Northumbria.
Oh, really? I think it sounds like something a French chef would make, ironically.
Yeah, I think maybe it's good when you see it written down. But actually, when you say it, it sounds like Ross-en-Y.
I'm having a Ross-en-Y gastric bypass operation.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm sure I speak for all our listeners when I say good luck with that. I hope it goes well, and I hope you recover well from it as well.
Thank you.
So next week, you're not going to be here, so we're going to have Mark Ferguson, who is editor of Labour List. He's going to be on with us, filling in for you. And you may be back the week after, but we're going to play the whole thing by ear. And if not, then I'll get someone else in. But hopefully you'll be back in a couple of weeks' time. I think you're going to have a period of convalescence afterwards, aren't you? So
yes, I have to be off work for a month. And it's not that I couldn't lie in a darkened room doing a podcast, but keeping on top of the news agenda might be a bit difficult if I can't concentrate.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Although that might make things easier for me. I might be able to get my own way a little bit.
Never.
Yeah, you wouldn't allow that anyway, would you?
No, if I could do nothing else, I'll still argue with you, Mark.
Indeed. Okay, well, like I say, I hope that goes well, and we'll have you back on soon, fighting fit.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank Audioboo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back next week.